Hey guys, it's your host Julian. What better way to kick off the spookiest month of the year than with a little Hey Arnold Urban Legends deep dive with series creator Craig Bartlett, composer Jim Lang, and writer from my favorite Hey Arnold episode of all time, Pigeon Man, Joe Purdy. I want to give a special shout out to all the patrons that help support this podcast, Bill, Brent, Brittany, Eight-Legged Bird, and Jacob. Thank you all so much for your support. It truly means a lot. If you want to become a member of our Patreon channel to help support the show and get all of these episodes early and ad-free, follow the link below and sign up today. Now, let's get to my chat with Craig, Jim, and Joe. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to What's My Podcast. I'm Mr. Julian. Today, I'm joined by composer for Hey Arnold, Mr. Jim Lang.
Hey, Jim.
One of the greatest writers of all time, Mr. Joe Purdy. Joe, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. Thanks, Jim.
Oh, thank you. And for the man that would be no show without him, Mr. Craig Bartlett. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hey, good to see you again.
Woo! Oh, that's glad.
Also, can I just say, Mr. Lang, you're beautifully lit. I mean, I'm all washed out. No. Lang looks like he just stepped off a magazine cover.
It's those Northern California fires are just like, you know.
And brings it out on you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thanks for joining me. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking urban legends today. Some of the coolest episodes I remember watching from Hey Arnold growing up were all of the urban legends. Before we dive into those episodes, though, Craig, I would love to know, how does urban legends come to be? Because you didn't really see this in too many cartoons, you know, especially during this time frame. So how does this one come about?
Our first urban legend was Stoop Kid. And that was those scrappy early days when we were really duking it out, trying to figure out what the show was going to be. And I love that even Stoop Kid had an urban legend built into it. And so we kind of set it up. It took a few more urban legends to really get the thing completely set up where Sid was going to be the gatekeeper and he was going to introduce it. And then he'd say, take it away, Gerald. And Gerald would tell it. We had Grandpa tell Haunted Train. Mm-hmm. And I think by the time they did Wheezanette, it was like Sid said, you know, the legend of Wheezanette goes back to 2 years ago, whatever. And then he gave it to Gerald. But we figured him out in the first half of the year, and we knew we loved it. And then each time we would do another episode and get it back, we'd go, I love this. Like, let's do it this way from now on. Let's have Gerald tell it, and let's have, and Jim, you'd often kind of do that kind of, I don't know, some sort of tribal thing where they were like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is something you might find interesting. Before we did Hey Arnold, I did a couple of projects with John Carpenter, one of which was called In the Mouth of Madness. And for In the Mouth of Madness, I recorded, there were, you know, evil creatures living under the ground. And so I recorded a bunch of voices on a 24 track of me going, and, you know, kind of layered everything 24 voices deep preset that I had made for that. And when we started the first urban legends thing we did, you know, when Gerald started talking, I just thought, I wonder what that would sound like if I put that underneath him. And it was like a kind of a slam dunk, you know, and everybody responded to it and it made it even funnier, you know. So
yeah,
so that's where all that stuff came from. And in fact, every now and then today, I still trot that stuff out.
Jim, you were finishing In the Mouth of Madness when we were starting Hey Arnold, weren't you?
I think, yeah, when we did the pilot.
What a summer, man. That was 30 years ago, y'all. Summer of 94.
Dude, I'm telling you, that was, there was a lot of stuff coming over the transom right then. And we were doing another show too. I mean, this is off topic from Urban Legends, but Craig and I were doing another show for like a theme park for Knott's Berry Farm.
Yeah, Julian, yeah, we've talked about Bob, I bet.
We have a little bit, man. But like I said, yeah. I didn't want to step on my toe. I love those stories.
We, you know, God bless Bob Rogers. That's how I met Jim Lang.
Right.
Amen.
So before we get into the episodes here, man, Joe, you've never been on the show, but Craig, how do you start working with Joe? How does Joe come into the fold for Hey Arnold? And then we'll rotate into the episodes right after that.
I mentioned to you, Craig, how I got in. I mean, you know how I got in, but of the original time, which is, but sorry, Craig, go.
No, it's August of, you know, well, August of 95. So, 29 years ago. When we got greenlit in January and started the production of the first 20 half hours, January 95, made the pilot in most of 94, all of 94. And in beginning of 95, we got the series. And by that summer, I'm lucky us, man. They let us add another staff writer.
And no, Rachel left. Remember?
Oh, it was because Rachel vacated the spot. Yeah, you're right. And so Joe had brought in, he came in with Pigeon Man, so he was hired.
Jesus Christ, that's how you open up your career at Hey Arnold?
He came with Pigeon Man. That was his pitch.
Can I tell you quickly, when I met Joe and Joe A and Steve. Do you want to hear this? This is an urban legend.
No, please tell me. Tell me all your stories, Magic.
I was avoiding Jim for most of my career. No, I'm kidding. I had snuck in, as it were, to the Universal Building, the big black tower in Universal City, because our friend Paula Kaplan, Craig has known also for years. She was working there. A friend was working as an exec, doing something at Nickelodeon. Anyway, I snuck in to use the Xerox machine to make copies of a spec script, because that's what you do as writers. And I was like, then, you know, go and sneak in and hand them to producers and get work. Anyway, and I was working on some other stuff here and there. And Paul was like, you got to meet these guys. They're starting a show soon. So it must have been like the end of 95. I don't know when you guys were in Universal.
We just basically occupied that office in Universal and also at 4040 Vineland. They had Nickelodeon space in both places. And they probably was right at the beginning of 95, Joe. It could have been the end of 94, but I think in the very first month, they just stuck Steve and Joe in that office building.
So funny. And I went and met them, and then they were like, hey, man, hey. And then they pitched something. They pitched Hey Arnold to me, and both were talking at once. I mean, Steve, you're not going to interview. But Joe, they both talk completely fast at once. And I was like, sounds good, sounds cool, sounds good. Hot off the press, here's some scripts. And then they called, which was really nice, came in and pitched some ideas. One of them was Pigeon Man, I'll tell you why. But and I was like, what, this is a cartoon? That's completely below me. No, and I had no idea from their pitch that it was animated, I mean, at all. And it was just—
Oh my God, they didn't make it clear that it was animated?
I don't know, because it was, you know, I mean, you can imagine Joe.
Two live action guys. Yeah.
And maybe there was a picture and it's really cool. And he has a friend and they live in a city. And I was like, cool, I'm from New York and I can do that. Anyway, and I was like, cool, we'll get it. Anyway, so yeah, then I think I met them in March. And I did a rewrite of DOS Subway.
Wow.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah. And then Rachel was leaving for personal reasons, Rachel Lippman. How lucky that, I mean, I'd met Craig before that, because I came in and pitched and was like immediate. I was like, you know, this was incredible. And we watched the pilot. I remember showing the pilot to my wife, these guys all know, and older son, Ben, and they were just like blown away.
How old was Ben, Joe?
Well, so Ben was, let's see, what, it was 94. He was born in 91, sorry. So he was
three or four when we started. Five the next year. Yeah, no, it's always fun having kids, you know, especially if you had execs that had kids, and the execs' kids are like,
I can do this over the weekend.
My exec story is, Linda Szymanski, who was a junior exec on the beginning of Hey Arnold, and then she
went over
and set up Cartoon Network, and then she quit Cartoon and went to PBS, and I brought her Dinosaur Train, a 30-second test we made, and she showed that to her kid, Dinosaur Train, the first 30-second test, and her 3-year-old kid said, no, want test, want episode.
She's a saint.
I know. Thank God for Sarah.
Thank God for Linda also.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Ahead, so anyway, that's how I met them. And it was kismet. And I mean, I could not be more grateful. And then like lifelong friends and creative and actual friends. But yeah. And also it was great because I could walk to the office when they were at Vineland. I was literally like four blocks away. I was like, this was great because we only had one car.
Well, thank you for sharing.
I wish we had video of Vineland. I wish we had taken that because it was like, I mean, that's a whole other episode to do.
A really good picture I can send you, Julian, is the one where we're sitting in Vineland when we just finished recording Parents' Day. But Joe is in the picture with Steve and me and the other writers, but Jim was not there. Sadly, Jim was over probably making music as fast as he could in Echo Park.
That place, like Animal House. It was like Animal House. We made a cartoon from like people. It's hot as hell in the summer. People literally, I think of that. People like just like wearing like maybe short, just underwear was so hot. Like guys just like shirts.
And that big, that was the 4040 Vineland. That space was like, it could have been anything. Could have been a dentist's office. But it had one big room that was like the killing floor. And it was just, the painters were in there and the layout guys were in there and the board artists were in there. And the lucky people worked in offices around that giant room. But that giant room reminds me of that Paul Simon song. All that winter we shared a cold.
So true. It's so funny, Craig.
Like, yeah.
It was crazy. I know. Well, it was crazy because it was like, and out of that, I mean, at the same time was, I mean, they were wrapping up. Joe Murray was wrapping up.
Hilariously, we were taking office by office. We were taking up Joe Murray's office space where he'd made Rocco, but which it was finished. I don't know how many they made, but they were done. And so they were like, you know, you're out on this date, you're out on this date, as they all finished up their last shows. So we
moved upstairs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Moved upstairs, and Steve Hillenburg was, I mean, my Steve.
Oh yeah! Oh my God! While we were there, all the time we were in the Vineland building, it seemed Hillenburg had one single tiny office, and over the window was a poster, a handmade Sponge Boy poster, because it was once called Sponge Boy, and that was all we had. That was all the information we had about SpongeBob was that for years Steve was in there making it practically by himself. And amazing. And then in 99 it came out and we were all like, look at this thing.
There needs to be a documentary on this.
It's
time
a monster.
I mean, honestly, I mean, I thought about, because he showed us all over the years some other stuff, and we were like, that's really cool. This seems like the furthest thing from anything Nickelodeon would do. And of course now, I mean, and Craig and I laugh about it. It's like, now literally everyone,
that's everything Nickelodeon is doing,
right? Yeah. And everyone that drove past Nickelodeon that day now claims to have greenlit it, or, you know, been my idea.
I'm glad I thought of it.
But like, you were a security guard for an hour. But anyway, that's the long, what was he at? What was the, that was a long, and that's how
Urban Legend of 4040 Vineland.
Well, if I got anything from that, it's just there needs to be somebody to do like a deep dive on that era of because I just had Joe on a couple before we took a break for the last month. I just had Joe on and he was talking about, you know, Steven had came up as well as a couple other people. And he had talked about just the entire, just what was going on, because he had did my favorite Rocco's Modern Life episode. And then it was just, yeah, he just went off to the side and he started developing it. And then it was fucking insane after that. And it was Nickelodeon after that. And you guys are saying it's the same thing. That's all they're really pumping out right now at Nickelodeon. That's their yeah, prized cash cow, their golden goose. Like I said, we're going to talk some urban legends, you know, so we're going to talk Wheezanded, Haunted Train, and Pigeon Man. Of course, I'm going to say Pigeon Man for the end, mainly because I don't want to cry on you, Joe, too early and make you, you know, have to sign off. So we're gonna save the crying on my end for the end. So where do you guys want to start? You guys want to start Wheezanded or Haunted Train?
Let's do Haunted Train.
Do Haunted Train. All right. So folks, if you haven't seen this, there's something wrong with you. Go ahead and check this out. You can get it on Paramount or you can get it on Hulu too. And then you can do like I did and buy all of these and keep them for a physical copy, because it's just something special about having a physical copy of this. So this one, we open it up with the kids being bored, you know, eating ice cream. They played checkers. They played every board in the boarding house. They've done everything they possibly can. And Grandpa comes over and spins a yarn for him and tells them about this haunted train. So I led it with Jim. In my opinion, out of the three episodes we're talking about, this is my favorite part of all of the music when it comes to this. This was my favorite episode when it came to the music. How fun was this one for you to do?
It was super fun. I've always felt like animation and horror movies had a lot in common as far as the scoring is concerned, because the score is really married to what's going on in the image more closely than it would be in a kind of like a normal dramatic thing or a sitcom or something like that. There's a lot less music, but in a horror film, there's a ton of music, and there's a ton of music in animation. So, and as Craig observed, I had just been doing stuff with John Carpenter, so my horror game was in good shape. But there's something really, something that we did always in Hey Arnold was to play the dramatic stuff, the big orchestral dramatic stuff, really straight up. I was never making fun of it. I was trying to write it like I would write it if I was doing a big, you know, 70 millimeter feature. And obviously I wasn't, and I'm not that guy. I'm not a conservatory trained composer, but that it was, all that stuff was the way it sounded in my head, all the scary stuff. And it was just so much fun to write, you know, because it was opposite, you know, really kind of like the opposite of what was, there's all this goofy shit going on in there. But the score was saying, no, this was really serious.
That's what I love, actually, the fact that Jim can score stuff. So it's all the joy of what we love about horror films. It's all there. At the same time, somehow, you know, he's kidding. Mm-hmm. You know, like, yeah. It's always like, don't worry, kids. You know, we're completely pummeling you with this dramatic music. But in the end, it's like, wah, you know, and it's going to be okay.
That's so probably true, why I didn't do any more films with John Carpenter. Because oftentimes, I hope John never sees this, you know, but oftentimes when I was working on those things, you know, they're so over the top that you would just think, this is almost funny, you know, that this is
like right into.
Yeah, it's, I mean, and it's great filmmaking. It's really great pulpy horror filmmaking, which is John's, you know, that's his sweet spot. Anyway,
I agree, though. I think Jim's ability to really bring it with the big movie stuff and turn on a dime, because they're 11 minutes long too, so
amazing. Yeah.
Hit you with one thing and then turn on a dime and then do something else, and he's light enough on his feet that you can tell it's going to be okay. We're kidding. The haunted train guy didn't really like lose his arm. There's like a smoking arm falls.
Oh, that's right. That's my favorite part, the smoky.
And then you see him. You finally see him in the end, and he's all patched up like Frankenstein.
It was a really fun episode, and with something like this, you know, you start to see, you know, especially towards almost the late 90s, you start to see a lot more holiday-esque episodes coming. Halloween, Christmas, you got some Hanukkah episodes in there as well. Would something like the Urban Legends, would they open up the budget just a little bit more to put a little bit more? No, so it was just the same standard as regular episodes?
They were treated like regular episodes. We had a little bit of give in our production where Tuck Tucker directed Haunted Train.
It's birthday today.
It's Tuck's birthday today?
Oh. Man, I know, to Tuck. I mean, talk about the greatest.
I'm so glad we brought up Tuck, because I happy birthday, I mean, man. I write it down because Craig shared my favorite Tuck Tucker story, because whenever somebody has passed, I always love, because we were going to talk Tuck Tucker as soon as we started doing a wrap up, because I love Tuck Tucker stories. Anytime somebody passes, I always like, hey, what's your favorite memory? Craig, I'll do a horrible job at telling yours that you told me the first time we had you on 2 years ago. And it was the shit sandwich in the fridge, and you weren't sure if it was a Tuck shit or a Bruno shit. That is still my favorite. And I've heard, I don't know what it is about animation and shit stories. Everybody has a shit story.
Everyone that's been
on this. Yeah. Everybody's got one from animation that I've had on that I've talked to. But Jim, I never got to ask you when you were on so many years ago, do you have a favorite Tuck Tucker moment, story, memory? But when you think about Tuck Tucker, man, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
I can't isolate a particular thing, because Tuck and I, we spent more time socially than we did on the job together, you know. But the thing about Tuck was, and I'm sure you know this, and Craig and Joe would attest to it, obviously, his sense of comic timing was unparalleled in my experience of all the stuff that I've done over the years. Tuck could nail the bend and stretch. He could nail the, you know, the amount of time that it took to get to an expression, to pay off a gag. And the, and for a composer, that is, that's like a hot bath on a cold day, man. It's like the music sticks to the picture like you wouldn't believe. And that's everything that I worked on that Tuck did. Well, I have to say the whole show, Hey Arnold, I've never done another show that consistently hit the mark the way Hey Arnold did. But Tuck stuff especially was just awesome that way.
Yeah, we had such talented artists working, and there were always four groups all working on boards at the same time. So Tuck really only got to do 25%. He really did more like 30-40% because I just squeezed that much more love out of that guy. But he was such a hard worker that he'd finish his thing and then plus up somebody else's. But and also he ended up in more and more supervisory directorial position. So that's their job anyway, is to and he would manage to be making something and boarding something and fixing other people's stuff and making kind of the very best visuals that the show ever had. I mean, no offense to Raimi or any of the other brilliant artists who directed and boarded.
Or none.
But Tuck just was there with me on day one, and he and I deeply communicated to him what I wanted this world to be, and then the rest is just him. He was so busy drawing that even if I tried to, I couldn't have controlled all the stuff that he made. He was always, you know, busy drawing the next thing. And the Haunted Train is just full of touches from beginning to end. And the setup at the front where they're on the steps and Grandpa comes out and tells it. Then they go down to the train station. There's a wonderful, long, magical pan down to the station. The interior of the abandoned train station is all Tuck. Engine 5 is all Tuck. It's just all Tuck. And when at the end, when he sings and plays the accordion, since we're talking about music, song by Jim Lang, that sometimes late at night, that one. you know, you look at him as that crazy leathery face that's sort of patched back together. We were all working together. Everybody was bringing it. And the collaboration was intense and really good right from the start, wouldn't you say, you guys? It's like people were always coming in going, how about if we do this? And I gave Tuck as much free rein as I possibly could because he was just so incredibly good.
What made him so special?
I mean, Tuck was just it was like one of these for me, because I'd never worked on an animated show before, but from top to bottom, like everyone was a true creative spirit, like through and through, which I know you find in showbiz, but it was just like extraordinary. And then it just became clear to me. And then, I mean, I know to everyone, then women like rose up, which was really nice of Craig and helping producing, et cetera. But still it was like, you know, like it was like having, I don't know, whoever the greatest, the GOAT, you know, on a sports team with you at, you know, it's like, I mean, it's Tuck. I think that Tuck also just like, you would say like, well, you want to take a crack at this Tuck? Or he would clean up a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And there was no, I know you were going to say something, Craig, because I have a couple of Tuck stories, but just quick, but you were going to say something, Craig, sorry.
That's it. You keep going, Joe.
No, two. First of all, Tuck never he never wore long pants. He wore shorts every day, no matter what. I mean, I may have seen him once in long pants. huge, hilarious, practical joke of the shit sandwich, which went on, which was like, you don't have to tell, but like I feel like it went on for months that someone was like stealing his sandwich, and he was like, I'm gonna get your mother. And you know, it was children's television. Which I mean, I learned like within 8 seconds because I shared an office with Steve Vixton, who, you know, at that time when we started had like the longest beard and hair in the world. He was like ZZ Top on steroids. But we and then
Howard Hughes.
Howard Hughes.
I mean, it was, and he may have, but he was Howard Hughes without the cash. And then with Joe, like, you immediately worked kind of blue and X-rated, except we didn't put it on screen. But anyway, and Tuck, you know, was right there with us all. I'm thinking of A, Tuck never, he always wore shorts. B, Tuck, when Cat Dog, you know, another great friend, that Peter Hannon started Cat Dog. And I think maybe it was Pavemeyer, but I feel like it was Tuck who started the huge, like, parody of Cat Dog that went on for like a year of all the artists. We were all coming up with Cat Dog, yeah, Cat Dog, yeah. Cat Dog Day Afternoon.
They were the kind of people who would, while they had a bunch of stuff to do, they would also have a group comic they were sending around. And Dan Pavemeyer spent as much time telling stories as working, and he still had, he got an incredible amount of drawing done. But I saw that Mickey K, I just posted last week the Mickey K line sticks out, and it had it all the frames of him swinging at the ball.
Oh, and I love it. I wish I'd seen that.
It opens with the pitcher on the mound, Spuds McGee on the mound at the first shot. And behind him is all the billboards with the names of all the crew on them, and like an auto parts, and, you know, Kenji's tires. And it said Dan's Philosophy Shop on one of them. Going into his office, like going to Dan's Philosophy Shop. But anyway, all of them worked on the show we're talking about. It was, you know, a giant group of people, and all of them contributed tons of original stuff to these stories.
Speaking of which, there's another thing that should not go unmentioned, and that is that Craig played Gerald's harmonica. Whenever Gerald was playing harmonica, that's Craig.
That was a very musical episode, Haunted Train.
They get to the
location, you know, he's Arnold, there is Helga, and then the three of them have to go to the train station at midnight, and they sit down and play the harmonica. And as I recall, Jim, we have the tune, and yet I know we just laid it down on the spot. I played the harmonica first, and Jamil sang it, and that's take one. You say he lost his mind, went crazy on that day, and that's like the Haunted Train song, but it's not. It's really two different songs. His first, like, waiting on a haunted train.
Oh, yeah.
And Jim's sometimes late at night, you know, and they kind of have the same refrain, but they're two different songs. And we recorded all that stuff on the spot. And Jim, you would probably were there to go, okay, that's good enough. I can take this and build it. So Jim was always my musical director in these things, but...
It wasn't like it was a super invented melody.
That's true. Jamil, what a wonderful...
That's what Jim invented, the blues.
Jamil Smith, the voice of Gerald, could barely sing in pitch. He would often sing, if you listen to It's Fruits from episode one, Downtown is Fruits, Gerald's just like, wrong.
Nice.
But god damn it, that guy brings it. He is, yes. Gerald, you know, even on episode one, it was like, he is so there. He brings it, and he brought it. Same with this one.
The spirit of Rex Harrison flowed in his veins, man.
Yeah. Anyway, wonderful timing, a wonderful performance. He busted it out instantly. And then later, when you were in post on that, Jim, you wrote the Haunted Train song. Wait, no, you must have. We had
it before. I think I knew kind of what I was going to do before we went into the record. I actually have no recollection of that session whatsoever, but it seems like I probably knew, you know, roughly what I was going to do. And I'm a huge ZZ Top fan, so I was, that's what I had in my head, was like a ZZ Top shuffle, you know, from the beginning. So that's where we
with it's it. Funny.
So plus, it's like a very
is there.
That's What's basically that? The that's basically the making of that episode. It's very, it's kind of musically driven, I feel like. And so the Josie wrote that script. And
I was just gonna say, Craig, because I looked it up when we were right, or I was like, I thought you did. Was it her idea?
It was, I think she pitched it, although we were very, in those earliest days, Steve and Joe and I would kind of try to plan everything. The three of us would all have to kind of like mutually agree on what a story was going to be. And then we'd give the writing job out to a freelancer or to one of us. And in those earliest days, we would write them all together almost. We would just like even get in there working on the drafts together. But then quickly, by the time we got to the middle of season one, everybody was so busy with their own thing that we worked less together and just kind of took stuff and ran. But Josie, that was her first and only script for us.
All right, as we take a pause for the cause, if you haven't yet, you should check us out on all social media platforms by searching at In My Head Pod. There you can see who we've got coming on, and if you feel so inclined to, you could submit a question to be asked. Now, let's get back to the show.
And we wrote the hell out of it. I'm sure, you know, we were, like I said, we were figuring out what the urban legends were and how we wanted to do it. And the point of that one is Grandpa is driving everything. He's mm-hmm. he's going, oh, so you're bored. I'm going to tell you a legend.
I'll tell you a story.
And then in the end, and it ends like all of our urban legends, like they're Arnold and Gerald are usually, or Helga are arguing. Definitive. There is no Weezin' Ed, or, you know, there is no haunted train, or Stoop Kid left his stoop. You know, you're kind of looking for absolutes, but, and Pigeon Man too, you know, where did Pigeon Man go? These are things that the fun of it is that to end it with a little like, did he, you know, I just saw Pigeon Man fly away, or the haunted engineer is riding on a train somewhere singing that song. And the train roars by Brainy, who's sitting on the fence where they threw him off the train and he landed in the mud. He must have cleaned up and put on a new outfit and got out there to be on the fence to watch it go by. So what can I say, man? These are cartoons. Their logic is like Swiss cheese. And the story points, the question I'm always thinking is it entertaining? You know, mm-hmm. And I love a mystery, and I love that the mysteries are solved and not solved. I remember the end of Four Eyed Jack, a second season urban legend that I wrote, and I just wanted to do a ghost story because I believe in ghosts. And I remember Rachel at one point going, wait, you don't believe in ghosts?
Right.
And I said, yeah. And then we just round and round, you know, argued about it.
So that was going on. That went on forever. That one, yeah. I feel like.
So I think that that's the fun of it is that, you know, we were intentionally trying to just kind of be circular and have everything get resolved and not get resolved kind of forever. That's how series TV works best.
That's why it made it a lot of fun not knowing if, like, fuck, was that real or was that, so I liked it. There's two scenes in particular with this episode that watching it back again this morning or this afternoon when I got home are still pretty vivid. It's when the lightning crashes before they go into the steel mill. And it's like they all go black, but they had the red outline around them. I had never really seen anything like that other than Batman, the animated series at that time. And I just thought it was really cool. It set the tone. It set the mode. And the other thing that I loved, anytime Brainy comes on and Brainy gets brained, it's fun. Like Helga just picks him up. Helga has to be the strongest person I've ever seen. She picks him up. And I think at one point in time, she's holding him by the belt loop by one hand, you know, and she just chucks him. Yeah, just chucks him. No facial expression whatsoever. She tosses them and they just go on with the episode. I thought
they close the door and then they arrive at the mill. Yeah, it's just one, it's just one moment. Yeah, that's a lot of that is Tuck.
Oh man, it really is. Episode was
probably wrote it as a group and Tuck ran with it. As I recall, it's a beautiful, moving animated shot where the train comes close, and as at its closest, you see her getting ready to throw it, and the train's already turned the corner and it's in profile when he flies out and lands in the mud. It's a beautiful shot. Just completely.
Yeah, that it was, man. Beautiful episode. And the next one we're going to talk about is Weezin' Ed. And I love this one for so many reasons. I mean, I alluded to it at the beginning, but three things stick out a lot. The first one, and I'm so glad I had the volume up because my kids were really loud when I got home. But I heard a name I have not heard about since I left Seattle in 2010-ish, right?
Ivers Fish and Chips.
Ivers Fish and Chips. So I got a when my first duty station, when I was in the Navy, I was stationed in Bremerton, Washington. We would take the ferry from Bremerton, Washington to Seattle because I didn't even have a car at that point. So I would get on that ferry on the weekend. I get there Labor Day weekend or whatever, I think, whatever holidays in May, that Memorial Day weekend. I go to Seattle. Seattle's done up. It's the prettiest summer I've ever seen in my life. I'm from Florida. It's 107 degrees outside right now with the heat index. Mosquitoes all over. It's miserably humid, right? I get over here. And I get on the base and they're like, you came at the perfect time. He was like, this is the greatest 2 weeks of summer you're ever going to have in your life. And I never understood what they were talking about until the rainy season started. So we get on the ferry, we go over, and the first thing we get off and see is I see the big fisherman, Ivers Fish, or I was at Ivers Fish. I can't remember the rest of the title, but that restaurant. And then I get there and I'm watching people feed the seagulls. Seagulls are snatching fish and French fries. I had a seagull follow us the entire way from Seattle back to Bremerton. I was just feeding them French fries the entire time. I just want to see how far you go, you know, but that was something that made me flash back to 2010. Right. The other thing, was a line that the fisherman used. He said, everybody can come over for a dollar, but he looks at Harold and it's a close-up pan up of Harold. He's like, but he'll cost $2. I thought, being a fat kid myself growing up, I was like, oh, that one stung on a whole nother level. And then
it sounds like a Steve line.
But anyway. Yeah.
The last thing that I thought set this episode so beautifully apart from the rest of them was there's a shot when Sid is setting up Gerald to tell the story of Wheeze and Ed. It has these beautifully like just still shots of these amazingly illustrated. It just reminded me of Where the Wild Things Are. Just the line detail, how rough yet how intricate it was, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
Yeah. And it's not like anything else that ever was on Hey Arnold either.
No, it's a one and done type of thing. So, yeah, it was beautiful.
That was our third urban legend, and we got that thing where Sid sets up Gerald, and Gerald tells it, and you dissolve into. And we usually would go, yeah, we didn't have any extra money for urban legends, so to go like dissolving from frame to frame, that's actually animation production wise, that's a way to save money, and so probably 12, 15 drawings. I'd have to watch it again. I haven't looked at it in a long time, but, and I think Chris Robertson was directing that section. And,
wow.
It may have been Chris.
I see that Dan and Julie Murphy
were the directors of, and Sherm, I think Sherm was a board artist on that.
I'm sure, because he was probably with Dan.
Yeah. And so somehow though, that art was something special. And I think Jamie Mitchell, our supervising director, may have that direction may have come from Jamie. But I thought it was great. It was really cool, and it is something new. It doesn't look like anything else. It has that storybook vibe, like you said. It has a kind of Prohibition days, gangster vibe that I also really like.
So with something like that, obviously, you guys, you're saying you're collabing and you're always trying to. Plus it, right? You're always trying to up the animation, the writing. Like, how would something like that, so I know this is fucking 30 years ago, so it's almost impossible to remember, you know, the finer details, but how would a shot like that
Greg
come?
Greg remembers
like,
everything. Thinking,
I wouldn't be surprised, but how does a shot like that like kind of evolve? Does it start from like, oh, it'd be really cool to have this one vague picture of somebody that might be Wheeze and Ed, or?
Yeah, we had a lot of chances for us to all get in sync on the story, one of them was a table read, which Jim probably didn't get to come to those. It would be a really rare like musical table read where we would have the luck to have Jim with us too. But the artists and the writers were and the crew were all welcome to sit a couple days before we go in and record the next script. And we would read the script out loud. And that would be our opportunity to talk about things like this. The supervising directors were there. The animation directors, like Larry Leichleiter, did so much great work. He probably the animation directed Haunted Train and possibly this one, possibly Ed. But they would talk about that. That'd be the time to express that. Like, well, what are we going to show for this? You know, and sometimes people would start thumbnailing right on the spot, but often that just the artist would then we call that a handout when the script was finished and recorded. And then I'd cut it down to 10 minutes and change to make an 11-minute cartoon. And we would sit with the script and the tape we'd made and play a cassette tape of the cut and hand it out. Basically go, so here we are, we're in the urban legend part. What do you want to do? And they often the artist would have ideas and say, how about if we do this? And we'd say, sure. And so it was very, yeah, that's where the collaboration happened. I'm sure Weez and Ed was just like all the rest of them. We recorded it, you know, table read it together, then went and recorded that final version, cut that down to length, handed it out to the artist. They boarded it. Then when it came back and got all, you know, the animation, you know, the animatic was done and the thing came back as animation, we'd cut it again to exactly 11 minutes. And then when we really considered it locked or that was picture, then Jim would come in, watch it with us, and that would be his chance to make suggestions about what he was going to do. So much of what Jim did, we would just go, there you go. And he knew what to do.
Let him cook.
Jim knew.
Amazing. Absolutely.
Only, God, I don't know, man. If I was like, often if I saw in the animation that I wasn't really communicating it to me yet, that I really wanted this to be about Big Patty and what she was really thinking, or that someone wants to do something, but they're not, I would say to Jim, you know, please make it so I can tell this is about what Helga's feeling, or this is about what Harold's feeling. But Jim knew what to do.
Greg told me something that's like early on in my career, because I was pretty much starting out when we did Hey Arnold. Craig at one point said, you know, in every scene, the composer is doing the job of looking through some character's eyes. You know, you're in somebody's soul, you're in somebody's spirit, you're their whatever in that scene, and that's your job. And so those conversations were always about that kind of thing. It's like, you know, what's Big Patty feeling? You're playing Big Patty for this cue, you know, or you're playing Arnold, or you're playing Gerald, or, you know, and very occasionally, you know, the scoring practice nowadays is a lot of times you're some ironic hipster standing off in the corner observing everybody else that's in the scene, you know, and that's the way things get scored. But in animation a lot back then, it was kind of the really traditional approach to it. And I thought, I've always found that idea super useful as a composer.
That's so smart, Craig. Yeah. It's amazing having learned, I mean, now, but having learned from both Craig and Jim and Steve and Joe, I mean, so much other director, but what Craig described, which sounds like, yeah, but it's this and this, was like so many steps. And the thing, and like, I just remember the first one, like Weez and Ed, I mean, I just love Weez and Ed because Craig and I know each other well. Like, we both love history, like Jim does. Both love history, both love mysteries. And so it's like, oh man, these are, you know, this is like perfect. So like, you know, when we did like the Orson or odes to many others, like Orson Welles on the Halloween episode. It's like, you know, unabashed.
Another horror story.
Yeah. But adding all these elements, like writing it was like, okay, you know, like great script. Thanks. But then adding, it's like, holy shit, these artists, like a talk directing comes in. It's like, it's so much better. And then honestly, I mean, I would say it even if he wasn't here. And then the music comes in. It's like, oh my Lord, like you could imagine it in your head when writing it, but you could never imagine that it actually would come to that kind of amazing fruition. So
that's but you bring up a really important point. And
finally,
if it's not there in the script, it's not going to be there in the final product.
Yeah.
I mean, we all do everything that we can to make everything that we work on as best as it can be. But honest to God, without the writing, shit's going to be flat. Excuse my French. It's the secret sauce that makes everything work downstream from that. You know, it's like, what, you can't build a house on sand. You know, you got to build it. You have to build a, You have to build it on something that's going to be, that's going to hold up the rest of the structure. So
yeah.
Off, gents.
Well, thanks, man. That's why, you know, that's why we're sitting here 30 years later talking about Hey Arnold, is that it did have good writing and it did have good music and it had good art.
It did. And also, I mean, like, look at it like now. I know that I don't know how old you are. I mean, like, so many people, but people 35. Look at it now. All right, cool. Like, right in the pocket, right? So,
yeah.
But also, like, things that we've all worked on since, and not to take away from them, they have been emotional. Like, we did emotional. I mean, Craig and I have done, and Jim, we, you know, we've done many series together now. How I'm so grateful. And, but I mean, to do these true emotional little movies that we got to make every episode. I mean, a lot of other series and some even couple that I've run, it's kind of like, that's a cute kid story. You know, this was just like, holy shit, here we have.
Yeah,
like,
it really got to go dark and deep. And I don't even know why, except it was the mid-90s. Wow. They were just like throwing money at us and getting out of our way all day long. I mean,
like, you should do an obnoxious guy harassing his daughter and a drunk mother and, you know, like, and all these weird borders, which, you know, hats off to Craig for coming up. Like, absolutely. That's what kids want. Like,
but, you know, I mean, the fighting and the struggling and the can we do it and can't we do it was mostly between us, all the creatives.
Completely.
Arnold, it was like a brawl where we were. And I'm so happy that it was such a brawl, because looking back, I can only imagine it was because everybody wanted it to be good so hard. They all wanted it to be so good, so hard, that we were all fighting each other, going like, no, childhood is about this. And so the result was, I don't know, man. I just feel like that was a great time to make cartoons, apparently.
Absolutely.
Got so much rope. It was hilarious how much rope.
We were so passionate. I mean, it was a brawl. Like, it was a creative brawl. We had, like, fights. And almost fist fights about story points on a kitchen.
Yeah. And Dan, like, Poppenmeyer, I remember one time Dan Poppenmeyer, they wanted to take, he got a note to take one line out. One line. Can you cut this line? He said, if that line is cut, the whole story makes no sense. And then it was like, geez, okay, Dan, you can have that line.
Do you remember the line?
I can't remember the line. I can't even remember the episode. Yep. I just remember Poppenmeyer and his courage of his convictions, and we all were like that. Everybody, I mean, I wasn't as dramatic as that, but everyone has their own style too. You know, everyone kind of has their own way of being.
Yeah. Such huge fights with Steve, like amongst us with Steve. I mean, about story point, you know, which was like,
oh yeah,
agree
Steve
with
Steve would go to the mat over stuff too.
Literally a word.
Absolutely.
But, and I agree with Craig, like, we were so passionate about every story that we wanted to, you know, and fights with Larry Lightletter and other, like, you know.
Totally. Larry would get really mad and upset and say, I don't want to do this one. And I'd be like, why? And it would be about some story point. He'd say, nah, you know, that's too much. You're going to ruin it. I remember Antoinette. I'd come into work and she'd say, Craig, you know, you're going to ruin Hey Arnold if we go ahead with this plan. I can't sleep. You know, she was pacing around. She couldn't sleep.
That waiting, famous morning.
In at 9 in the morning, like, what are we going to do about this? So, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I have not had that kind of working experience since, honestly.
Yeah, Dinosaur Train were like, holy shit, that's a huge dinosaur. What are we going to do with this one?
Yeah, anyway, back to Weezinhead.
So before we rotate into Pigeon Man, I wanted to circle back to something you had mentioned, Jim, and something that I find so, it's perfect. Like, I've told both of you at the same time that I don't think of Arnold without the music. I don't think about the music without Arnold. They're very symbiotic. It's, you can't have one without the other. And I don't think there's another show out there that I think about like that as much of it, right? So how do I even fucking word this question, man? I mean, how much easier is it to work with somebody like the creator that can speak your language, Jim? Because I got to imagine you've worked probably with a lot of people that can't really speak music the way Craig can. So what is having somebody like that to work with like?
Great question.
Yeah, I think this whole, the whole thing, it's an ongoing conversation in the composer world about musical language and how difficult it is to work with people that don't have musical language. And I think some creatives are, they find it difficult to talk about music because they feel like they don't really have the technical language to talk about mm-hmm. music. Like they don't know all the Italian words for the different things that happen, or, you know, they might think a French horn is a trombone, which is a really easy mistake to make, or they might think a guitar is a mandolin, another easy mistake, you know? So there's always, you know, people have egos and they want to not screw up. And so these conversations can be super fraught. I don't think Craig and I ever talked about any of the music in Hey Arnold in language that was arcane or elevated or anything. I mean, we, you know, we're of an age. We grew up liking and listening to similar kinds of music. Craig is one of the most musical collaborators I've ever had. I mean, we must have written like 200-300 songs together. He's a great singer. Oh my God. You know, it's like falling in love with somebody. It's easy to take all the good stuff about that relationship for granted. And I take Craig for granted. Everything we've worked on, I've taken him for granted to the max, you know. And I get notes from him from time to time, but compared to other projects that I've worked on, almost nothing. And the indication there is that we're blessed with,
we're speaking the same,
having, yeah, we have sensibilities. He solves problems. I like the way he writes scripts and songs. You know, our songwriting process is he'll write a lyric, he'll send me the lyric. Sometimes he'll sing me a little bit, like the Dinosaur Train theme that was totally Craig all the way, you know, from the very beginning. But, you know, the amount of input varies from song to song. But we've never really, at least I can't, you correct me if I'm wrong, have you ever had a struggle? God, about any,
exactly. We would always, the thing I love too is it's always very result oriented. You're going to sit down and have a session and you're coming out with something because you have to. We're making TV and we're on a schedule, and so I love that. It allows us to not be too precious and just go like, you know, what do you think of this? And I love too. I love how this stuff lives forever, Jim. It's like, we went to, in April, we went to Dallas for the Total Eclipse with the Ready, Jet, Go team. And the Ready, Jet, Go band is me and Jim, Jim's son, Garrett, our old pal from the guitarist on everything we've ever done,
Nick Kirgo.
It's a bunch of old friends. And we sing those old Jet songs that we wrote in 2014, 2015, 2016. They're now 10, 9, 8 years old. And it was so fun to just go, I love it. We just had to write these songs because that's what that episode called for. And now these songs have a life and they're going to just be out there. That's what I really love about music making and songwriting. I'm so glad I got to get pulled into that world. And Jim mentored me through all that stuff. I played a little guitar and sang a little bit when I met Jim. And by now I'm a professional songwriter.
Who knew?
And that's with this, this correspondence course, I now have a degree.
Talk about urban legends.
It's right. It's on the job training.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary to watch. I mean, I don't really need to say anything, but to watch them together, because it was like complete marriage of the minds and mm-hmm. melody of the minds, because never, like, the easiest thing, and also like dear friends.
It's great to be able to even know people for this long, as I've known these two guys.
Yeah, and also it's kind of funny because I think that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Craig, like, cause, you know, like working to, like, how Joy, we do it in a do it back in a second, like, all the stuff went on in the office, like, you know, then you're in the middle of production. It's like literally sometimes, like, I don't know, well, especially like Dinosaur Trip, like sometimes like, you know, 10, 15 scripts of all different and productions, things coming in to watch, things writing stuff, rewriting stuff. And I think it probably was a joy to go like, can I just go and do music with Jim? Like, I'm sure you guys are all fucking crazy.
I loved any session where we had to go and do music. It was always the most fun. When we would record, we only had a couple.
Yeah, the cool musicals that also
had many songs to get. The opera and Eugene in season 5. But those were the happiest times I ever had. I remember, and now I'm going way off subject, but I remember when we recorded the opera all afternoon at Horta in the winter, as I recall. And then we left that session after just like, it was like, you know, you were like, I could have danced all night. You know, you're just like, just like wired now. And we had to go to an all company meeting, remember, in the ballroom of the Sheraton, Universal Sheraton that Albie was running. And we walked into the room and the door opened and the whole Arnold crew that had gone to the recording session came late into that meeting and everyone got up and cheered. And I didn't know why. We burst in the door and they all got up and cheered. And I'm like, they must be grokking how high we are on that. You know, I literally like, I could have danced all night. And I just want to say that those sessions were the most fun I've ever had professionally. Incredible. Yeah,
they were those really were not good sessions for sure.
So music making as a part of cartoon making, just like a huge piece, just like you cannot replace that piece.
I got to say, I look at the stuff that Dan, I know this is totally off subject, that Dan Pavemeyer's done, you know, great series that he's done, he and Swampy have done at Disney. And I mean, he's a musician. But he got, you know, I think he was watching Craig and he maybe, you know, contributed to some song like What's Opera. He had a version of, he contributed to that. Then he was like, God, I get to do this. He totally watched what Craig did.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, totally, you know, the hands-on song making is the one of the biggest benefits of this business. I can't, and the way music and animation work together and the way they fold into each other is better than live action. The end. Fight me.
I can't agree more. Well, thank you for expounding upon the relationship between animation and music. I really appreciated that. And then the last one, this last episode, like I said, I told you, Joe, this is where you're getting hot tagged in for this one, man. This is all you. Pigeon Man, this is the bar when it comes to any Hey Arnold episodes. If I've got to go and if I meet somebody that doesn't know what Hey Arnold is and I know I can get them hooked off of one episode, I'm giving them Pigeon Man. There was so much heart in this episode. There was so much just beautiful. It was beautifully sad. You know what I mean? I told Craig this story. If it wouldn't have been for this episode, I don't help a pigeon myself. You know, I'll make this one really quick. I was staying with my older sister. There was a pigeon that was walking around and it was, its wing was busted. It was dragging its wing. And I was like, hey, Shelly, that's my sister's name. There's a pigeon. It's acting weird. She's like, well, go pick it up. So I went and picked it up, expecting it to fly away. It didn't fly away. I was able to pick it up. There was a little band on the bottom of his foot. I called the number. This guy at this time in Orlando was training pigeons to either be not so much a Chester, like a carrier pigeon, but he was training them as like a racing pigeon, I believe is what he said. It's been a very long time. This is going back like fucking 20 years maybe now at this point. But I called him and he wanted to give me a pigeon. Right. My mom's like, I'm not giving you a pigeon. And I love pigeons. I've always wanted a pigeon. And my mom said, no, absolutely not. So I got a cockatiel out of it instead, named him Nacho. He was the coolest fucking bird in the world. And if you guys remember a show that Danny Antonucci did back in the end of the 90s and early 2000s, Ed and Eddie, theme song by Patrick Caird, right? It started out with a whistle. My bird memorized that the entire summer going from fifth grade into sixth grade. And he would wake me up because every morning Cartoon Network in my house was turned on because I'd be the first person up at 6 o'clock in the morning. And Ed and Eddie was that first show on. My bird Nacho whistled that whole fucking song. Right. So for a year he was going. And then the first day of summer comes around. This little bastard, I tried to sleep in one time. He woke me up at 6 o'clock in the morning whistling Ed and Eddie. So there was a huge thank you for not only getting that cool bird, but getting that cool story, but having such a huge and deep connection. That's with this episode. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, what a story. That's incredible.
Thank you. But what a story. We're talking Pigeon Man, though, right? So this episode, like I said, beautiful. The dialogue alone. I mean, I could have, you know, read back your entire, I'm pulling it up now. I could have read back the entire episode about how beautiful this dialogue was. But there was something that I've thought about so much, especially after rewatching this episode today. It's right after Harold, and we're skipping a little bit ahead, but it's right after Harold and Stinky and you know, the gang go up there and wreck Pigeon Man's house. You know, Arnold had just taken him out for pizza. I thought it was funny how even back in the 90s, you guys were shitting on pineapple and ham pizza, because that's something that people are still discussing and fighting over now. But I thought that was a really cool moment. And the moment I'm talking about, you know, he's like, we can build it, they'll come back. And then he goes, of course they'll come back, they're birds. And then he's like, I trust them. He's like, I understand them. It's people I don't understand. And now so more than ever is that last little bit of that line of dialogue you read, so fitting for the time, right? I just don't understand people. Obviously, before we hit record, you had said this is like the first episode you had pitched, you know, when you guys were, when you were coming on to Hey Arnold. So I got to know, how does this episode come into your head as Pigeon Man? How does Pigeon Man start?
Sure. And I'll tell you, and then I'll give Craig huge credit because he helped a lot, honestly. But so Pigeon Man, before moving to LA, I'm from the East Coast. I lived in Hoboken, New Jersey, which we all have to do our Hoboken time together. And of course, as if you've ever seen the movie On the Waterfront, so I love that movie, took place in Hoboken. Have you ever seen it?
No, I haven't, but I'll write it down.
Yeah, On the Waterfront.
Brando film.
It's the I could have been somebody, I could have been a contender. Maybe you've heard that line movie. I could have been somebody. So it takes place in Hoboken.
Scored by Leonard Bernstein.
What's that?
Scored by Leonard Bernstein.
By Leonard Bernstein. Carl Malden's in it. He's the priest. I mean, it's a great.
Brilliant.
It was like film. I mean, anyway, it was filmed years before I lived there, but it was filmed like a blog. People are like, that's where Frank Sinatra lived, and that's where they filmed On the Waterfront. Anyway, On the Waterfront, a big part of it is that he is like this thug, but he's sensitive because he has pigeons on the roof of his house. So I always like that. And so it's like a city story. I combined that when I pitched them, I combined that with a loner. I just like that, the loner character. And I just remember just writing the outline, and I just like I married that with at the end of Grapes of Wrath. So
did we all go like, he needs to make the Grapes of Wrath speech, or did you just bring that? I can't remember.
I know I came up with it, and then you all were like, yeah. And then and there was no doubt. I mean, thank you for the compliment, Julian, but there's no doubt. And I was, you know, it was like my first or second script that there was notes on it, definitely. And I always got notes, and I still do to this day. It's like, it's too talky, too many words. I was like, you know. But I mean, Craig was like, this is an urban legend. Like he said, this is a legend. And so, and really helped, you know, structure it. So, I mean, thanks again. Thanks for the compliment.
Cool. Just think, Joe, that's Pigeon Man's actually about like 15 half hours in, right?
Yeah.
Like 15A or something. And, by that point, we knew like Arnold helps a guy. That was like
a big category.
That's one of the A categories of the series. And so it was a perfect Arnold helps a guy story. And he reminded me a little bit of Boo Radley too, from
that's exactly
from To Kill a Mockingbird.
No, exactly.
And come on, Vincent Schiavelli. The actor, the character actor, the wonderful character actor who plays him and who plays Mr. Bailey in the Christmas show.
And who plays Mr. I mean, do you know who he is, Julian?
Mm-hmm. People, Arnold. It's people I don't understand. I mean, you could give that guy the phone book and he'd make it sound great. And so we really had a wonderful thing going there. We had Joe's script and Vincent to read it. And you notice on the spot, we named him Vincent.
We did.
And Arnold at the end goes, Vincent, we just thought of it there. Like, shouldn't he call to him or say something? And so Vincent. And it's so great. I know that stuff was all being cooked up on the spot.
Oh, we did it.
And the guy was, you know, Vincent was a wonderful actor and super. He was having a ball and
well, first
super
of all,
into the part and
so into it. Do you remember for so the script? I got to say, I mean, a lot of scripts went through a lot, and the music. I mean, I know it's again, music so enhanced it. But that script was fairly easy in the process. Like it was just there. I mean, so I'm lucky about that. And then I was like, got this, nailed it. The next one was probably like 50,000, you know, like 50,000, you know, drafts of it. And it's like, this, whatever the next one was. Anyway, but I didn't even know.
It probably was such a good, solid idea. Just so good. Like we knew he's going to be this weirdo. Then he meets him and he says almost nothing. He's like Boo Radley. Arnold gets through to him and invites him to pizza. That's another great read when Vincent says, Arnold says, don't you miss, you know, I don't know, like pizza? And he goes, pizza. Oh, pizza. And then you
I know. Pizzeria.
It's Italian like a little music is playing that Jim provided. And he's like,
totally.
No, this one's bad. Is this, are these bits of pineapple?
there's like, I mean, I grew up in a small town, like right near Hoboken, and right, and like there's always weird, in any city, there's always weird characters. And I just love that also he went to, he had Miss Slovak, like, she's still there? Like, he went to the same school. And that vision at the end, we talked about it. Craig and I mean, we definitely came up with that together because I like the idea that at first he was going to, like, be, I thought, like, a pigeon carried him off. And I was like, it's a cartoon. Why can't it happen? And then the idea that they all did, and whoever, I'm not sure, whoever maybe.
Well, that was great because then that becomes his costume at the very beginning. He's wearing that crazy harness with the little
the ring, you know,
rings in it, grommet. Yeah. And he strings up, and it's all magically done, all boarded by Jay Lender. That's a great sequence.
That's all right, Jay.
I think it was Jay's first board. And so they.
Wow.
Camera Jesus line Christ. Like crazy. It was a hot mess, actually. We were flopping shots, and there's even a shot where Arnold's flopped, which I hate because then he's got 4 points on the wrong side.
Right.
Symmetrical hat ain't where it's, you know. But yeah, Joe, a very early Purdy script, very first board for Jay, that, you know, that kind of stuff is probably why those shows. We're talking about them 30 years later is that everyone is kind of the thrill of we're all kind of taken off, you know. I think that
literally.
That a lot of really good energy in that. Let's talk about the ending too.
No, I was just gonna say, hey, how lucky that, I mean, I knew, like, I was like, I can't believe I'm doing this as a cartoon. Not that anyone cares, but I know, like, I grew up in a house without a television for whatever reasons. Ooh. And not never, like, hardly ever watched cartoons. I got an education in college. But did I ever watch a cartoon straight? Not high. Anyway, and then with these guys, but like a joy and like putting it out there, like I could see, like, oh my God, conversations immediately with Craig and Joe and Steve. Maybe Steve, I guess Joe was still there at that time. It was like, we can do poetry. That's why I was like, this. We can do, you know, something that's a little nihilistic and poetic and hugely emotional. So that, I mean, to do that episode, to like put that out there was still to this day, like, so grateful that we could do that. And the end, I know we talked about the end. When it happened, I was like, Jesus Christ. Also kind of literally along, like, people are going to like, that's, but we were, I mean, I don't know. I think that we were all like, that's juicy. I know that Steve, I remember Steve distinctly saying, like, be hilarious, because Steve was always like, we got to button the button on the button on the end of every episode. But he was like, wouldn't it be hilarious that, like, later that night, he's like, I miss Pigeon, like, you think? And then, like, he crashes into his ceiling in his room. It's like, well, I tried. Those fucking pigeons couldn't really carry me for like. Like,
oh, man. And instead, I think partly because it really is a kid's card.
I never heard that.
I know.
That's so great. So, yeah, hilarious. Those kind of conversations we'd have were, what if, you know, if Snow White gets married and a year later she gets divorced? You know, it's just like the fun of like imagining what would happen next. But it's 11-minute kid's cartoon. You gotta jam those three acts out as fast as you can. And the end when he flies away. That's a kind of a funny, lucky ending, because it's a sudden ending. He harnesses up and flies away and says, you know, kids are still making memes out of that. Always remember to wash your berries, wash your berries. Fly towards
the wash sun. Your berries and fly towards the sun.
So that, I think that's really loaded. Cool. It's like it's like you got to get out, and that's why those stories end the way they do. You have 11 minutes and away you go. And I also will add that when that show was done, we knew we had something great. But then Lang put the music on it, then it became really fucking great. Just like the baseball. I showed the cut of the baseball to Herb Scandal because I knew he was a baseball fan. Our became the president of Nickelodeon, and he was out visiting, and I showed him baseball going, look, you know, Arnold's going to be a cool show. It's going to be, it's going to have this stuff in it. But then I showed him only the cut without the music, believe it or not, because Jim hadn't done it yet. And then when Jim put the music on it, I was just like, oh, this just became 10 incredible. Times better. You know, it now it's inextricably connected to Jim's music. You'll never be able to look at it without thinking of the music ever again. And it's the same with Pigeon Man. Pigeon Man has an ending that's just like heartbreaking. And I think it's there in the script. Jim gives us the credit. He says, you know, you can't do it without a good foundation. So I think the script is there, and that's why Pigeon Man is great. But then Jim put that music on, and it's just like, now you never think of it without thinking of Jim's great music.
Absolutely. Also, I got to say, Pigeon, I mean, again, grateful and like how lucky to make such kind of a deep and emotional story. But also at the end, when we were talked about it then, and then, you know, we were in the midst, as you know, and we'd like moved on to the next one. We knew, you know, that was a really wonderful experience. That was a good one. I could just tell, like, oh, that's going to be. But at the end, talking about the end, I when I just like wrote it down, I was like, can we do this? I saw it as hopeful because he was like, he was getting away, and he was with his best friend. He was like, you know, with pigeons. So they were going, it wasn't like he was going to a better place. Like he was dying. Yeah. He was literally probably going to a better place.
Literally going to a better town. He was going to find a new It was
going
to be
he's going to Pigeon Town.
Well, I never understood that about the fan base until I had, like, right before I had Craig on, I had posted, you know, hey, if you could ask Craig any question, what would it be? And literally, like, 12 or 13 questions was like, did Pigeon Man kill himself? I didn't know that was a fucking thing, because I see that moment. I see that shot. Even as a little kid, you listen to what he says. I'm going to go, you know, he's like, I got to go somewhere else type of thing, right? And I'm like, oh, so he's just going to go somewhere where somebody's not going to wreck his fucking roof and mess with his pigeons and mess with him. Yeah. He wants his peace and quiet. He told you what he wanted. He wanted to be with his friends, which was the birds. He wanted to be away from people because you couldn't trust people. But he left them with that little piece of, and that's what I loved about Arnold so much, is like, you guys never talked down to us. You talked to us. You never talked at us. You talked to us, right? And it was one of those things where it was like you would pick up these life lessons as a kid. You know, it's like, be kind to people, be kind to animals, you know, fucking be the best person you can be. You don't have to be perfect, because there's every character, even Arnold is flawed in this show. And you guys dealt with such heavy shit. I mean, I told Craig for our Christmas episode last year, the Arnold's Christmas is one of the most beautiful, heartbreaking, uplift. It's perfect. That's the second one I always tell everybody, is like, oh, you got to watch the Christmas. You're going to cry on both of these episodes. And, you know, I had told Craig, it's like that shot where, you know, Mr. Nguyen in Vietnam is coming in, and you're starting to go through the kaleidoscope of his emotions. You see the blue for sadness, the red for rage, because somebody's invading your country. And then he does, like, I'm trying not to fucking get choked up now thinking about this, but especially being a dad, you got one goal when you start having kids, and that's to fucking protect those kids and give them everything they can to be a successful member of society. And then the only thing that he could offer that kid, it wasn't money, it wasn't anything other than his unconditional love of him lifting up that, like, that is such a powerful fucking moment. Him lifting up that baby to give to that soldier, because he knew nothing was good was going to come from if they stayed there. You know, if they both stayed there, they probably both could have died. He gave that baby the best option of living and becoming something by leaving. And that I can't imagine. And that's a fucking kid show. That's a 30-minute cartoon on Nickelodeon. You know what I mean?
And we're like,
Wild West, man, 1995.
I mean, how lucky were we that
Wild
we could
Wild West.
And, you know, and also to come around, I mean, Craig and Jim know, like, we work with people that grew up like yourself, like grew up on it, and like now grew up on even earlier things or later things. But I absolutely, it's funny because I don't, you know, like the rate, we're in the radio, the world of rating things, but that's really nice of you to say. I mean, I like, there's so many that Craig wrote, Hellgun on the Couch, and early ones. That
that's another great one too.
Like that you can't, you know, like, oh, well, actually, I love Joe and Steve, but they would be like mine, whatever mine was the best. But that's a whole, that's another podcast. It's like, okay, you win. But I got to say one very quick thing. When Vincent Schiavella came in to record that, you know, he's from Go, like he's really tall. Like he's, I don't know how tall, but he seemed like 6'8". He was like
8. And he would wear a hat. He was a giant.
He wore like a full, he three piece suit, total dandy with a cane and a hat. And was like, okay. And like we're schmoes and Life with Louis, like Louis Anderson would record like right before or after us. And he literally slipped on a banana peel. That's a whole other episode. You should do this. I saw him slip on a banana peel. I was like, are you kidding me? But Vincent came in. He was like so cultured. And he said, I just came back from a cooking institute in Italy. His like grandfather was the cook. Do you remember that? Our chef?
Schiavelli.
To some like, you know, huge duke or something in Italy. Anyway, it was like a whole thing. And it was like, it was like its own little indie movie when he arrived. So that was just, I always have. And he passed when I remember when he passed away, like at Christmas time, yeah. A few years later. Anyway. Yeah, that's
glad we got him for those two bits, man. Oh, yeah. And Bailey was in the movie too. So Vincent came in a third session and recorded for us then. Yeah, but just a treat to know a guy like that.
Oh man, it's a treat to have an episode like this. So I figured, I'll cut this next part out. Jim, are you still with us? Or are you still frozen up?
Uh-oh.
Looks pretty frozen.
He's
having connection.
Yeah, probably. So what I figure we can do is we could end it here. I'll see if give him another minute or two to see if he can pop back. I know he's been having issues the last 10 minutes or so. You know, like I said, we'll pick it. I'll cut that last little bit out. But you know, Joe, for the first time being on the podcast, man, thank you for coming on. I like I said, I mean it when I say it. It's like this is the greatest, in my opinion. I love all the episodes. I've told Craig this, so you're going to hear it again, Craig. I apologize. But like, there's not one bad episode of Arnold. I can count on maybe like one hand, you know, how many shows that I think are absolutely perfect. You know, you guys are there. Hey Arnold's there. Hey Arnold's there. Samurai Jack is there. Regular Show is there. You know, and I'd really have to sit there and try to think and pull any other shows out. But like those three in particular, when I think of cartoons, I think of live action, I think of anything, there's not one filler. There's not one bad episode. There's not one going like, fuck, I could have done without that episode. Perfect. Jim, welcome back, man. My the monologue, let the old internets keep up, catch up. You know, there's not one bad moment in Arnold for me. It was, like I said, Arnold, King of the Hill, the other one I can't remember. I don't understand why I forgot that one. King of the Hill is the other one. Hey Arnold taught me how to be a kid. I had to be a good kid. Hey Arnold taught me how to be King of the Hill taught me how to be an adult, you know, the things that I should do, you know. So I've learned a lot through watching characters work shit out on the screen, you know what I mean? The music, Jim, hopefully you're still here and you're not frozen up again. The music by itself, I mean, it was beautiful. And then you had the beautiful animation, the beautiful writing you guys did. It was just one hand was just like, it was like this. It was a match made in heaven when it came to Hey Arnold. So forever grateful for the shows you guys did, the music you did, Jim, and then the writing you did, Joe. Perfect. With that being said, we'll end it with this, man. Joe, when you think of Hey Arnold, is there one thought, one emotion, one word that comes to mind, or one memory that comes to mind while working on Hey Arnold?
Those are all different things. One word is.
Well, here, let me reword that. When you think of Hey Arnold,
yeah.
Okay, I got you.
No, I got it. It let me write the freedom of working with the most creative people that I've ever worked with, and to tell the stories that probably would not be able to tell on stage, screen, or, you know, or otherwise, or in a movie. So just grateful, and just like the best memories from hilarity
to lifelong friendships, to huge fights. You know, I mean, it's in a weird way that the life of Hey Arnold behind the scenes was like, was on the screen. You know, it was like, you know, the joy, love, emotion, you know, like we were all Helga at times. We were all Arnold at times. And we didn't even get to Harold. And you, and but anyway, that's the long answer. So, and you know, forever grateful. Like I have like these great friends, and it's not just great friends who understand, and you spend so much time together, you understand each other and you understand each other creatively. And to have that kind of mind meld is like, you know, once in a lifetime. So just grateful.
Thank you for sharing that. What about you, Jim? When you think of Hey Arnold, your time on Hey Arnold, does any one memory, one word come to mind when you think about it?
No, there's all different kinds of joy. Mm-hmm. And we live in a world where joy is in short supply right now, I think. But there's a kind of joyfulness and sadness. There's certainly joy and laughter. There's joy and friendship. And also for me personally, the joy of getting to do something really for the first time in over a period of what, 7 years, Craig? I mean,
seven, 8 years we were doing that.
7, 8 years that has continued to give me. The most joy of anything that I ever did as a creative endeavor in my life. So that's the word that comes up for me.
Now, Craig, you're last to go, and I've asked you this question twice now before. So let's shuffle the deck just a touch, man. But when you think about Joe and Jim and being able to work with these two gentlemen right here, what's one thought, or you know, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you see the name Joe Purdy and Jim Lang?
I think about all that time that we got to spend together, and it's sometimes in short supply. Like Vixen died, and I was like, wow, I guess I was really lucky to have all those years where Steve came in every day, and I had him to help me do what I wanted to do. Same with Tuck. Tuck died. I felt the same way. Like, that's it. I was really lucky to have had him for all those years working so hard for me. And these guys are still going. So they're a resource today and tomorrow. So I think it's the longevity of this. We're 30 years in now. 30 years ago, Jim and I had already been working together and made the Arnold pilot. And the next year I met Purdy. And so the incredible longevity is really nice too, because it gives you a chance to kind of see things. We have a really long vision now of what happened, and so we can really see it for what it was. When it was happening, I think we were pretty busy. And we knew we were having a good time, and we were able to communicate that on the spot. But you know what I mean? It's like you're just so busy that you can barely even stop to take note of how much fun it is. I know we were having some fun though. I know we were even conscious of it as it went down. It's even seems sweeter now though, because like we say that, you know, you don't get those kind of opportunities on every job. And so it's funny to look back and go, man, we really had it in the mid 90s. That was a time where they were just throwing money at the problem.
So lucky.
Problem of making entertainment.
And so lucky that we got to do so many other series together. My gosh.
Yeah.
All these other Larry, well, you know.
I know we have to wrap it up, but I'm gonna take a moment here since we were talking about Tuck. I found these today. This is a pencil drawing of Tuck's design for Veterans Day, a fourth season special, half hour special.
That's so cool.
The winner. This became the color poster, but this was his other trophy, which you can see. I've stamped my approval on this drawing.
That is so fucking cool.
I love it. Hitler's trying to kill Grandpa, apparently with a bazooka. Grandpa's
like, you do
that out of the way, and he's gonna hit to poke him in the eye. And Arnold's
hit him with a curly. Like,
yeah, Grandpa. Yeah. That happened.
Anyway, that was so cool.
Chuck Tucker probably busted those out in exactly 7 minutes.
The watching Tuck like that. I mean, that was like, I know we
have to. Pencil drawings, man. Look at how that's got a little bit of shading on it, because Tuck just naturally had so much graphite built up on his wrists that it didn't erase away to reveal the light.
You got to frame really those, Craig. Like, you got to frame those.
Yeah.
Craig has so much to frame. He had like have millions, but there's amazing. Yeah, like you'd be talking like an idea, and Tuck would be like something like this, and hold up like it's like. Like it's
yeah,
like
we those table reads.
Lisa? Like oh, that'll do.
The backside of your script has nothing on it, and so we draw constantly while we table read and show it and go. What if you know? What if he pokes him in the eye like Curly?
I know it's all like Grandpa. Like we've all sat in different rooms, like different you know for other projects recently. Kids have people have grown up like yourself. I'm Arnold, and so like yeah, not many talking about Veterans Day. Not many series got to do. Grandpa giving Hitler a wedgie, and we didn't get a note on it.
No, like, by that point, they didn't even give a shit. We were completely on our own. Season one, we had to fight for everything. Season four, they were like, huh?
Yeah, fuck it.
They delivered it.
It was like that, you know.
Lang, I remember late in the run, Jim, you were like, I wish they had notes for me. I feel like I'm no one even, are they even, you know? And I said,
listening?
Bro, they just love what you're doing. Everything's fine. Don't worry. You can get as outside as you want. And Jim, you were like, God, Dad, I want to do this score sounds like the Art Institute of Chicago. Yeah. you know,
I did spend some time trying to break the machine and never succeeded.
That's really fun.
It just makes it better. Later, people are just so people can be forever scratching their head going, how the hell did they get to score a show like that?
Amazing. I always thought we should do a live. I mean, you did some live shows, a live show orchestra. Maybe we still can. Orchestra playing your music, Jim. It's so incredible.
Yeah. Well, they did it with the Animaniacs. I can't think of his name. It was Rob Paulson.
Rob. Yeah.
I just can't think of the who was it? Who was the other guy?
Maurice LaMarche is the brain.
Well, yeah, it was Maurice.
But
I can't think of the guy that wrote the songs. Randy
Tom Ruger.
No, it wasn't Tom Ruger. It was Rand. I can see his fucking face. He was on Batman the Animated Series. He wrote the song with all of the countries in the entire world that Rob sang. And he did it twice, and they took it on the first. It's fucking Randy something. It's going to bother me for the rest of the night. But nonetheless, man, you said
Paul
you guys.
Paul Rugg, is it?
No. It's not Paul Rugg. It's we anyway. Talked, and then he's got one of those episodes that I'll never be able to release. Him, Joe. I actually had Joe on way, way back in the day. And a couple other episodes. My laptop was stolen way back in the day, so that episode was on there. But yeah, they went and did a whole orchestra style show. Rob would come out and sing it. They would hire the local orchestras. They did one in Orlando. They did one in a few other places before COVID and then shortly after COVID. And then they sold out like crazy. So I have to imagine that's something you guys can do. I mean, you guys have done vinyl pressings and they've sold out damn near fuck within the first week or fairly quickly. So I got to imagine you could take the music of Hey Arnold on the road with you guys.
Great idea.
Yeah,
I mean, still trying to make that happen someday.
Randy Rogel. Randy Rogel was the guy's name. Randy Rogel. But yeah, so 30 years, and here's to 30. I don't drink, but I'm drinking some water tonight, man. But here's to 30 more years of friendship. What the fuck is that, Craig? Because that's some cool shit.
I think maybe I said something, and they took it as a cue.
30 years. Maybe that's the anniversary fireworks.
Yeah.
It's Craig's appearance at the Democratic National Convention.
Yeah. Great speech, man.
Thank you.
Great speech.
I have to bail out. I have to go cook dinner for my wife.
I have to do the exact same thing, Jim.
I have to cook dinner for Jim's wife also. That's
Well, he's been Jim. That's been Joe. That's been Craig. This has been the What's in My Head podcast, and this has been another piece of your childhood. Good night.
Hey guys, it's your resident cartoon junkie Brandon Jones here, asking you to have a listen to my Animation Destination podcast. It's an animation celebration podcast, and it's full of all sorts of stuff about anime and cartoons and voice acting and all that sort of thing, and just a really all-around celebration of anything animated. So come on by and check it out. We've got fan episodes of your favorite animes to your most obscure cartoons on Netflix that no one's ever heard of, and just really love talking about it. You can subscribe to us on Spotify and iTunes and anywhere else you can get your podcasts from. So stop on by, subscribe, and stay tuned for the Animation Destination Podcast.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. Before we go, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with the podcast today. I truly appreciate every download and listen we get. If you're liking what we're doing, drop us a 5-star rating, drop us a review, tell a friend, and I'll see you next week.